Hey everyone, I'm Chris Lesniak.
And I'm Rob Beyer, and this is
the Debate Math Podcast. Welcome to our very first bonus episode.
Woo-hoo. From time to time, we may release a bonus episode to revisit an episode that needed to be unpacked.
And there was just so much talk about episode 2, and our guests were excited to continue the conversation. So we thought we'd invite them back for a bonus Q&A segment.
As a reminder, the original debate topic was stop making students memorize. Let's have our three guests reintroduce themselves, remind listeners where you are and what your current role is.
All right. Well, I'm Mandy Tolan. I'm a high school math teacher in Northern Missouri.
Hi, friends. I'm Liesl. I am in San Diego, California, and I'm a former math teacher. I've taught everything from kindergarten up through ed programs at the university level, and I'm the co-author of Brain-Based Learning.
I'm Rod Shaw. I am owner of a math enrichment company called Mathless Academy, which I've been doing for 14 years, and also proud to be a co-founder of the nonprofit Global Math Project.
And unfortunately, only three of our four guests could be here today. Jeff Krall was sad not to be available, but is a bit too busy with his semester to join us right now, but sends his love. But with that, let's jump right into our questions.
We reached out on social media and compiled a list of questions from our listeners.
So I guess we'll start with talking about the word memorization. So people talked about how the words we use really matter. And someone asked, what does the word memorization make you think or feel just when you hear that word first off?
So when I think of memorization, there's a lot of anxiety associated with it. Like timed tests, like the first thing that comes to my mind are the timed tests that we think of in elementary school. But as a teacher, when I think of memorization, I think of formulas and sometimes things that we wouldn't necessarily need to store, but that we make students store instead of just having a resource for it.
My experience with word memorization has evolved over the years. So when I was a student, as a learner, memorization, because I grew up in that same era of rote memorization and timed math tests and all of that. And so that's definitely in my history, and it's in my psyche of feeling that way. And then as I became a teacher and started experiencing the struggles of being a young teacher and trying to dive into how learning really happens in the brain, then my feelings have evolved. And my current understanding and beliefs and feelings around memorization is that's our goal. Memorization is, for me, memorization is connected. I don't even like the word memorization as much, but it's connected to having the information stored in long-term memory. So for me, it's more connected to memory now, whereas it began as rote memorization. So memorization would be like the verb, and then memory, like having it in memory. Help me, somebody. Is that like
the location where it's stored?
Yeah. So I think you're drawing a distinction between what is stored in your mind and how you recall it and whatnot. Mm. And you're making a specific comment about long-term memory versus short-term. And I think when a lot of us think of the word memorization, we associate it back to how that information got stored in our minds. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of our argument or discussion in the previous podcast was about the how. Is it rote memorization? Am I just looking at something and going flashcard, 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 day after day after day after day with no connection, no understanding of where it comes from, no understanding of what it means or what it looks like or anything? Or has this quote unquote fact or thing become stored in my brain over the long term because I've had a lot of experiences with it and they're connected to other things? And I know 3 times 5 is, you know, related to 3 times 4 and whatever else. And there's some connections. And I know it looks like, you know, an array and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of our conversation probably will revolve around how does something end up in your mind for the long term? Because I think we all agree that you do have to have things stored in your mind to do the more complicated, interesting, fun, rich, creative mathematics. I don't think there was ever an argument about that.
Yeah, and I would agree. And that actually takes us into, we had a question that came to us from Berkeley in California. Berkeley said, he wanted to know, would you differentiate between a fact that is memorized versus one that's automatized or automated?
So for me, if it's automatized, that means it can be retrieved without having to be constructed from scratch. That's how I would describe automation. And so does that differentiate from having it be memorized? In my opinion, no, because like Raj was just talking about, there's multiple ways to get things, quote unquote, memorized, meaning like stored in long-term memory. You can take a really ineffective, unengaging, forceful path of a rote memorization process, and that could still create automaticity. Many of us grew up in that math world, and we were able to like just spew things out without really understanding what we were spewing out. So either way, whether it's done through rich conceptual understanding and social play-based visual manipulative exploration, it can still get back there. One is a stronger memory than the other, and one is a more joyful experience than the other, but they both could produce automaticity.
I think I agree mostly with that. To me, automaticity means I can recall it quickly without really much context or thinking about. I think in the last podcast, we talked about like multiplication facts. Okay, it's okay if you forgot what 7 times 8 is, if you can figure it out from 4 times 7 or something like that, right? Doubling and halving or whatever strategy you want to use. So to me, automaticity is I know 7 times 8, 56, boom, versus not automatic is I kind of know it's related to 4 times 7 and 2 4 times 7s is 28 plus 28, 56. That to me is not automaticity. Even if I can do it fairly quickly, I wouldn't call that automaticity, although there might be some fluency or something involved in that. But yeah, that's so I think I agree with you on this.
I do too. And I think with the automaticity, we can talk a little bit about, are we storing it in that short-term memory or that long-term memory? Because the long-term memory would be the automaticity in my mind, because it's there and you can readily recall it. Where a lot of that rote memorization that we're talking about, we do just store that in our short-term memory to get it out as soon as we have that next assessment, and then we don't have to worry about it again.
Well, then that brings me to like the word fluency, because that's oftentimes maybe misdefined, or there are some things that are some misconceptions with the word fluency. And where does fluency fit in with memorization and the automaticity? Where's fluency's place?
When I think about fluency, and I'm sure people have thought about this much more deeply in the context of mathematics than I have. But when I think about it, I think about learning a language, being fluent in another language, Spanish, French, whatever. And I think about, okay, I have to memorize some vocabulary words in order to speak that language. That's maybe memorization and automaticity, and maybe I even use flashcards. I don't know. But in order for me to speak that language to someone else and have a conversation, that's fluency, being able to put the words together, know what they mean in a context, formulate things, be creative, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that's fluency. And so if I think about that from a math perspective, to keep banging on the multiplication drum, I don't know, all my examples are the same, but like now I know 8 times 7 is 56 automatically, but can I use that? Or do I see how that's related to something else? Or, you know, can I figure out 14 times 8 from that or something? That to me is fluency, because I'm now bringing to bear multiple different ways of thinking about mathematics and strategies and putting them together with my automatic facts to construct something or communicate in some way.
Yes, I mean, I totally agree. And I think language is a really great example when you think of like when I tried, I am not fluent in many languages. I can have moments of fluency in some context, and a little bit of Spanish and Danish from the years that I spent living in Denmark and starting our school over there. But you know, when you're starting to learn another language, it's like, okay, so I can learn a verb, bailar, right? I'm going to dance or something. But then if I'm going to try to decompose it to, okay, so now I'm going to talk about like, we dance. So now I need to get plural and past tense and all these things. And it's not fluent if I'm having to decompose all of those aspects. And I think that's the parallel here with math, is that if we're simply retrieving it with minimal effort and not having to reconstruct it, we would be considered fluent. And I think there's some things that we would want to have fluency in with math, and other things that, you know, I don't need to know every single word in any language. I got Google Translate here in my pocket. I think this is another helpful metaphor, is to make sure that we understand that I don't think any of us here are promoting fluency or memorization of all things mathematics.
And so another question someone asked on Twitter is there a difference between memorizing and learning, and how would you differentiate those words?
I know Liesl has a comment for this, so I'm going to jump in before she does, because Liesl's got a lot of research to back this up. Mine is a little bit more anecdotal. So can memorizing and learning be the same? Yes. But what we have a lot of times, at least what I've seen in high school, is that students think that if they memorize a formula and they can plug numbers into it and they can get an answer, that they've learned math. And I'm going to put that in quotes, that they've learned math. And that's not necessarily the case. It means that they've learned a process, but they don't necessarily understand what the process is doing. They don't understand how to use it beyond that specific application. They probably can't even apply that to a new situation or a different situation unless it looks exactly the same as what they did immediately. And so while they can be the same, we do sometimes confuse the memorization of a process with learning and understanding what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of things you said there, Mandy. And this is complicated. Like, we really get into like some theoretical things. I don't know. This is what I wrote in my book. It says, learning is the process of acquisition of new or the modification of existing knowledge, behaviors, skills, values, or preferences. You could say that, hey, if I, wrote, memorized, and just like cram some stuff in there because I just use the law of repetition, like the brain follows the law of repetition, that if we repeat something enough times, we will likely remember it if we do it enough. You know, my heart says that's not the kind of learning that we're looking for. You might be able to say, yeah, so I quote unquote, like Mandy said, with the quote marks, I learned it. But I don't think any of us joined this profession to make that kind of learning happen with our students. So for me, in order for it to be learned, I would love for it to be learned in a meaningful way and in a way that can be applied in other contexts. So they actually know what it was that they learned.
Yeah. And then that kind of summarizing and maybe repeating some of what you said, the big discussion we're really getting at here is the question that was all on Twitter and stuff is, how would you define the word memorization? And people are really thinking now what they mean by the word memorization. So I'd like to hear from each of you, and maybe we'll start with you, Raj, and go over to Liesl and then Mandy. Just how would you define it, or what are the key aspects of it?
I don't think I want to define it. How about that for an answer? It means too many things to too many people. I think it's going to be really hard for us to just say, this is what memorization means. I think we've been clear here and in pretty good agreement of, there's a class that we'll call rote memorization. There's another class, I don't know what to call it, where the learning is happening in a more natural, more connected way. There's still repetition that's happening, but it's a more natural, like I said, I just said natural and connected way. And so, I mean, generically, I guess memorization is the process of committing something to long-term memory. But again, the how is what we're debating, and the why.
Should we just get rid of the word memorization? Is there like a new word we should be emphasizing?
Well, I think that's the interesting thing about being in education, and those of us who've been around for a while to see the trends come and go. Memorization, and then we bring in, automaticity, and then it's fact fluency. And we just continue to create these new buzzwords, and we have a really hard time defining them, as we all have experienced here. And the conversations on Twitter are evidence of that as well. And, I think we could get caught up in the semantics, but like Rashid, I think what's most important is recognizing, well, I believe that memorization is the process in which information is consolidated into a new memory that is stored, hopefully, in some long-term way in the brain. Yeah, I think the more meaningful conversations are what and how do we do that? Because like I've said, it can happen in a forceful way, or it can happen in a really meaningful way. And we just continue to create new buzzwords in education.
And a combination. I don't think there's anything wrong with rote memorization per se, right? I mean, and certain things have to be memorized by rote because they're not connected to other things. Why does I come before E except after C? I have no idea, but I memorized it.
Except for all the weird words for it.
Except for all the words that rhyme with neighbor. I know. That's the second clause. I know that part too. But it's memorized. I don't know where it comes from. I have no context for it.
And I think that's exactly what we're talking about, is when we have those things that are memorized, and maybe at the time, and even that's stored in your long-term memory. Like, you can recall that, but you don't have the context to put it together. And I think that's what we're talking about here. Like, we know that memorization is the storing of information in our brain. And I think what our debate really is how do we store it? Because we talked about the pedagogical approaches that we could use. Some of them are good, some of them not as good. And then the purpose for retrieving that, like, do we know when we retrieve it, how to use it, why we're using it, and what does it connect to?
Well, I just, for me, some of it, so much of it always just comes back to, what is the purpose of education? What's the purpose of school? What's the purpose of math class?
Why, especially once you,
right, like what is the purpose? Because is the purpose for us to learn, and I'm doing my quotes again, to learn as much math as possible? That's when we get into like the race to calculus conversation. Or is it, you know, people will talk about, it's about, you know, like critical thinking and thinking mathematically and problem solving. And depending on, because there is no alignment on that in the math ed world that I found, people will approach learning in really different ways.
So that actually kind of leads us into, and going back to how Mandy said, it's more about the how we memorize. So this next question actually comes from Sarah from Minnesota. And she wanted to know, can there be accidental memorization? For instance, she does a lot of measurement conversions because she cooks and bakes all the time. And she's seen the decimal equivalents of 3/8 so many times that she just knows it. So is this something that can happen? Maybe even at the higher level of math. I mean, we were talking about fractions here, but even if it's like Pythagorean theorem or whatever Chris teaches, any of that stuff. So what do you think?
Well, that's repetition. I mean, her seeing it over and over again, that's the repetition that we've been talking about. And I mean, honestly, and I tell my students this all the time, one of the reasons that you really can't store all of that math information, like Lisa was talking about, we have varying opinions on this. I am of the opinion that we cannot store all of that information and recall it in a purposeful manner. And so I would rather them be able to think critically about things and be able to use the information that they have. And so in a job, like, and this is what I tell my students, if you go to a job where you do have to use these things over and over again, you will probably store that information. You will probably memorize that information because of the repetition of using it. And that's the information we want you to store, because it's what you're going to use for however long you're at that job.
I really love Sarah's question. It really gets to the heart of how learning happens in the brain, which is something I'm really, really excited and passionate about sharing with people. In terms of like accidental memories, I mean, absolutely. If we're talking about memories in terms of like something that you learn, I mean, we do that all the time, right? We stub our toe and we accidentally learn that our bed is a little bit further into the room than we thought. A small child puts their hand on the stove and they accidentally memorize that this thing can be hot. And those are episodic memories. And so those happen through, you know, some type of like physical experience or an episode that happens in our life. What Mandy's talking about is, I think, mostly like declarative learning. And that is like facts and information. You know, it's like, oh, this war happened these dates and these were the generals, stuff that like these just dates and facts and stuff that we learn. And if we are just like trying to shove it in there, then things can get really messy and they're really unmeaningful. But when you consider what our brain naturally remembers, what Mandy's doing a really great job explaining is some of the different ways that the brain remembers things. And so one, like, just everyone who's listening, just think about what you did. Do you remember what you wore yesterday?
No. Absolutely not. I can barely remember what I wore before I changed 30 seconds before we went on.
That's a whole nother conversation about how our brains are just like really struggling right now because of all that's going on in the world. But if you really sat here for a minute, you could probably think about what you wore yesterday. You might even be able to go back another day and think about what you wore the day before that. You might be able to go another couple of days back. And then if I said, okay, so what do you, who remembers what they wore on, I don't know, May 15th, 2011? And almost no one's going to remember. But there might be someone out there. And listener, if you are this person, make sure you jump on Twitter and let us know, because there might be someone who's like, oh my goodness, that was my wedding day. I know exactly what I wore. Or, you know, that was, oh my goodness, that was my nephew's quinceañera. I remember like shopping for this really, you know, unique outfit or something, you know. So it reminds us that the brain remembers or memorizes certain things. One, it can happen through repetition. Some people are like, oh, like I had a job in 2011 where I wore a uniform. And so I know that I was wearing this outfit because I wore the same thing every day. Or the brain remembers things that are meaningful. You might not remember what you wore on May 15th, 2011, but think about what you do remember from 2011.
Wow.
Yeah, you certainly remember some things from 2011, just not everything. So the brain remembers things, either what we repeat, which is where rote memorization got its popularity. Like, oh, well, that's the easy way. Let's just like pull out the flashcards and go, 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 go. And what we're learning is we learn more about how the brain learns is that when we take the path of meaningful learning, which brings in the conceptual understanding, the manipulatives, and putting it in some kind of context that's meaningful to the learner, and bringing in another person because people are meaningful to us and social learning is really helpful, then we can learn or encode into memory things that way as well. And they're not mutually exclusive. You know, there's probably benefits to both and some kind of combination. But, you know, just rote, repeat, repeat, repeat is not, I'd always prefer to try to find the meaningful path.
Well, and so you said something about like purposeful learning. And I know like I'm going to actually kind of throw this to Raj a little bit. It's more in his wheelhouse. When we talk about gamifying things and trying to make things a lot more fun and engaging for students, you know, there are a variety of different games to learn, whether it's math facts or math vocabulary terms, like, and there's so many things you could do. So I'd like for you to touch on that. But before you touch on that, the tried and true game that we all played, that we probably all love because we beat everybody in the room on it around the world with flashcards.
Dude, I own that game.
We all like probably own this game.
Fourth grade. I've got memories of that long term.
That's exactly. I have long term memories of that too, because I was up smiling and standing and dancing and others were not. So I want to kind of talk about that and then kind of lead into some of your favorite games that you like to play, whether it's for fact fluency or otherwise, Raj. And then we can go around the horn on this one.
Oh, man. Wow. That's a big topic. Just to piggyback on what's been said so far, I think it's that Lisa and Mandy both made a good point about how different experiences can get into. It doesn't always have to be about repetition. It could be something emotional that you hang on to, or an important date in your life that you hang on to and you remember details and stuff like that. And I think another piece of that is, I'm pretty sure the research shows that if you are curious about something and then you learn it, you will hang on to it. You tend to hang on to it a lot longer. And it becomes more meaningful for you. And so, you know, I think curiosity is a thing that is vitally important in a math classroom. And too often we come in and we basically say, today's fractions, nobody cares, here we go. And I think that's to me is really, really important when we talk about engaging kids. You know, if I don't have any need to learn this, then what are we even doing? And so it's incumbent upon us as math teachers to figure out how to make things that seem maybe not super exciting, find that curiosity moment in there somewhere so that kids will lean in and then want to learn it. And then all sorts of good things can happen from that, including storing things in your long-term memory. And now to answer your question about games, I love games. I don't, they're like my children. I love them all equally. I just think games are just an amazing way. People love to play. Human beings love to play. It's a fundamental thing. You know, you go back thousands and thousands of years and people are throwing bones around and turn them into dice. Like, so anything you can do. And to me, every game you can think of, I defy you to think of a game that's not a math game. Scrabble is a math game. Sorry to all you word people out there, but I know like 7 words in the English language and I will crush you at Scrabble because I can get that triple word score somehow or the other. You know, they're all word games. Wordle is a math game. It's a logic and reasoning game. Yeah, you got to have some vocabulary, but it's a math game. So I don't know. I don't. And the only caution I have sometimes is that I think we try to make things that really aren't games into games and trick kids into playing them. And that's when I get a little frustrated. There's a lot of video games out there where it's like, you know, you're doing this thing and then, oh, pause, we're going to do 17 multiplication problems. And then you can go back to having fun. Like that to me, I'm sure we all agree about this, but there's a lot of stuff out there like that too, that you just kind of have to watch out for.
Well, and that I want to go back to the around the world game, because I still see it, you know, every now and then. And, you know, I've been trying to caution away from it. And like, there's so many other really cool games out there that you can play, especially if you have dice, dominoes, and playing cards at your disposal. So can we talk a little bit about like, just maybe a couple specific games that like, that you like to play? It could be one game that any of you like to play or have kids play, that kind of helps with that.
I have so many. Goodness. So many. So I taught kindergarten and first grade last year, and we learned the math curriculum 100% through games.
Oh, let's go.
100%. We played games every single day and my students loved it. And they're like 3 grades above grade level now when they went back to their other schools now that once the Zoom school was kind of done. And I do want to make the comment, like, yes, in 4th grade I owned, or 2nd grade, whenever it was, Around the World. I think that is for all the people listening, there are other better games that you can play. Things about Around the World that I would caution against is, one, it promotes speed. And that when you value speed over, you know, like conceptual understanding and deep, meaningful understanding of what you're doing, ultimately that's going to come back and bite the student in the butt. And it's going to impair their math identity, likely lead to more math anxiety later on and lead to further problems. So one, there's like the speed issue. The other is it's competitive between students. And competition can be really motivating for a lot of students. But the ideal circumstance for competition, especially at that young age, would be competing against myself or groups competing against other groups or a class competing another class. When you compete one person versus another person, you've got that one person literally, the way we played, literally standing above the other student who is sitting down. I mean, talk about the physical hierarchy that you're creating and the intimidation. In terms of like public humiliation and shaming, it is a 2 thumbs down no-go. Absolutely no-go for Around the World, in my opinion.
Well, and Lisa, real quick, I want to add on to that, because what I often tell teachers is that, you know, who's getting all the practice when you do that and who needs all the practice when you do that. So yes. It's kind of counterproductive, because you and I and Raj and Mandy and Chris, we got a lot of practice on things that we already were good at. And then there were others in the class that needed the extra practice and they weren't getting it. So that's where like I try to steer away from that and do like what you said, or like Raj has said, and Mandy's probably about to tell us as well. So
For me, just you were asking like my favorite games. I like Raj. I don't know if I could pick a favorite. I'm sending math games with my kids to school every single week so that they can be playing games with their classmates. This week, what went into my son's kindergarten class was Get Out of My House, which is a game created by the amazing Michael Minnis. Michael, I'm so sorry if I pronounced your last name wrong. He creates amazing math games for the lower elementary level mostly. And you can find them on Twitter and on YouTube. And they're amazing.
So I agree with everything that has been said. I really dislike anything that has a time limit on it that forces kids to guess instead of think about things. And so I am all about any type of game, and I don't know that I could pick one either. I mean, in high school, especially like when we're just reviewing integers or combining numbers together, just a deck of cards, you can do so much with just a deck of cards. But anytime I create an activity, I will either put them in groups so that they're thinking together. And my students will tell you they love to work in groups. We call it sharing a brain. I said, you guys can always come up with things together that you might not be able to come up with on your own. And everybody's participating, everybody's listening. Even if one person's talking, the rest of them are listening. So they're working together and they're still learning. But just like escape rooms, I used to do escape rooms in my math classroom. And I loved doing escape rooms. The problem was I had 30 students in my classroom. And even if I ran two sets of escape rooms, you still had students who were not participating because there weren't enough tasks to do, which is why I create digital escape rooms. And I let them work together as partners. And so they are interacting with every single task that I want them to interact with. And they're talking with somebody about it and they're still doing it. So no time limits, making sure everybody has an equal opportunity. And yes, because even like the review games that you play, like the baseball games and things like that, the students who know the answers get the answer and then nobody else has a chance to think about it. And we just don't want that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're hearing a lot of good ideas, especially game wise. And I want to just dig a little bit more into like how to help students memorize. And you said something in the last episode, I think maybe it was actually Jeff, about the difference between memorizing and bad pedagogy. And so this question comes from Tim in Virginia, who asked if you could say more about what good pedagogy around memorizing looks like.
So my understanding, and this is all outlined in my book, is that there are three phases to the learning process. If we want information to get all the way to be permanently stored in long-term memory, which there is no limit to, unlimited storage in long-term memory, there's three phases. Raj mentioned the first one, and that's perhaps the most skipped over phase, which is a big problem because once you skip over the first phase, the second one and the third one, they don't happen very well. And that first one is getting the brain ready to learn. And that is prompting curiosity. Your brain's, the three best tools for your brain to get them ready is to prompt curiosity. So that means instead of writing your learning objective or your standard on the board, you convert that into a question that prompts their thinking, that gets them curious. You pull in their interests. I taught in Florida for a year. I had no idea how dominant the football culture was. So you better believe that every Monday morning, there was a question on the board like, how often did FSU lose with a wide left field goal? And they're like, how dare you bring that up? Like they just lost over the weekend. And you know, you bring in the things that are relevant to your students, which is why relationships is always going to be a part of a conversation around effective pedagogy. So you get the brain ready either with curiosity or with anticipation. Is that your second biggest one? Is anticipation. So it's those little teasers. Hey, make sure you're here tomorrow, because tomorrow we are going to discover how you can use math to break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend in the most mathematically effective way. Get ready. I taught high school. My kids were rushing to get into my classroom door. And the third one Ross mentioned as well, and that's relevance. So you have curiosity, anticipation, relevance. If you can start your lesson with any of those, making it relevant to them and not this like, ooh, the lawnmower can mow 13.7 hectares in 7 3/4 of an hour, like all that junk, you know, but some real relevant math tasks, then you got the brain ready. When we skip over that, then your amazing lesson is just going to fall apart. So you get it ready, and then you learn. And this is what people will probably, this is what Tim's question is probably asking about. And that is I'm just passionate. And everything that I know about the research of learning is that there is always a place for manipulatives and physical, active, visual learning in any subject, but especially in math. And you want to, it's called multi-sensory instruction, and just it activates many parts of the brain simultaneously, which just improves the learning of it. And so I'm just like social learning, learning with a buddy, always. We always like, the default in our education system, the default is we do things independently. And I don't know how that became our default. The default needs to be social learning. We learn, we're social beings, we learn socially. And so we used to always be asking ourselves, is this something that they absolutely have to do by themselves? Or can they, as Mandy said, you know, share each other's brains or borrow each other's brain power and maximize their learning? So my big ones are social learning, play-based learning, multi-sensory instruction. And I haven't finished the whole three phases, but I'm just talking too much. It's readiness, consolidating, which is all about making the memory connections happen. And the last one is, is all about retaining it. And that's just keeping it in there, which is a whole nother conversation.
Now going into that, talking more about what students should memorize. So like we've probably talked about ad nauseum at this point about the basic facts for elementary students. I'm going to kind of go to Mandy or Raj. So outside of just the basic, like addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, even, is there anything else that maybe elementary students should have committed to memory prior to them leaving elementary? And then also, like, what should middle school students memorize or have memorized?
Wow. A list. You want a list?
Well, let's just give some facts.
got a couple examples.
I think we, you know, I guess the way I think about it is as little as possible. And maybe that's not the right way to think about it. I don't know. But that's how I try to think about, can I teach this in a way that makes so much sense and is connected to so many other things that you know that you don't have to forcibly memorize it? Will you memorize it over time? As Sarah said, accidentally, you know, if it is something that you're going to use over and over again and is useful, then yeah, hopefully you will. I don't know what that list is exactly. I know for my own, just reflecting my own education and going through physics and whatnot. I mean, there's a lot of formulas to memorize, but I always felt more prepared if I could derive the formulas than if I had them committed to memory. Because that meant to me that I understood the first principles of things and could then reconstruct. Now, of course, I'm not inventing new physics. It's stuff that I had learned and I'd seen before, but you know, I was able to kind of reconstruct it. I think about that with math in the same way. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that was a good answer or not. I didn't give you a list.
Well, Mandy?
I'm also not going to give you a list, but I am going to give you a couple of examples. One of the examples that I get from students coming from middle school to high school, like I'll say, okay, we're going to talk about the Pythagorean theorem, like a squared plus b squared equals c squared. Like, absolutely. And then I put a triangle up. Which one's A and which one's B? Exactly, because they know this formula. They can rattle that formula off, but they don't know how to use it, which, by the way, I don't teach a squared plus b squared equals c squared. I write leg squared plus leg squared equals hypotenuse squared every single time I do it, hoping that by the time we're finished with my class, that's something that they have stored so that they see that we're using the legs of that right triangle and the hypotenuse of the triangle. So I try to make even what I write more meaningful, knowing that they may eventually store that. And I would rather it be something useful like that than a squared plus b squared equals c squared that they don't understand. And then to play off what Raj was saying, I use Peter Liedahl's Building Thinking Classrooms in my geometry classroom and absolutely love it. And so you're always starting with the lowest level concept that you can build on to get them to kind of construct that information. And a lot of times my students will say, oh, well, there's a pattern there that I could just memorize. And I'll say, yes, if you now see the pattern, you probably don't have to memorize it, because you see the pattern. But if you don't see the pattern and you're trying to use this pattern that somebody else sees, it's probably going to be more difficult to you. Let's just go back to what we were doing before. So we were talking about 45, 45, 90, and 30, 60, 90 triangles. And with the 30, 60, 90, I started with an equilateral triangle and we were talking about similar triangles and what we knew about that. And I said, guys, you have the information that you need for this. You know the Pythagorean theorem. You know the information that we've been using. You don't need to memorize the little trick. And that's kind of what I call it. You don't need to memorize the trick. If you see it, use it. But if you don't see it, use what you know. And I think that's just a better way for students to do it. Then if you can't memorize that little trick, it's okay. You can still answer the question.
So yeah, that's a really interesting example. I just want to riff off that for a second and see what the group thinks. So in a 30, 60, 90 triangle, there's some relationship between the three sides. I can never quite remember what it is. There's a one and a two and a square root of something or something like that. But I always remember that a 30, 60, 90 triangle is half of an equilateral. And so within a reasonable amount of time, I can rederive which one is the one and the two and the root something or the other. Is that the right thing to do? Or should I have committed that to memory?
Bum, bum, bum.
It probably matters about like, when am I ever going to use it and how often am I going to use it?
Right. Then we get into the theory, you know, the.
Yeah. If I'm taking the SAT tomorrow, I'll probably want to memorize it.
Exactly. So what's the purpose of education? What's the purpose of math education? What's the purpose of the math class? We're going to keep coming back to that.
Yep.
Depending on how we answer that, how important is this content? Like this is more of a curriculum conversation. Is this an important thing in the curriculum to remember? I will say that I do know those ratios. I do have them memorized. And that is because when I taught those with my students, yes, we derived them. Yes, we explored them. Yes, we had our patty paper out and we were doing all the things. And once we found the ratios, you know, we explored it together. And then at the time, it was deemed important enough for us to hang on to that and not have to reinvent it every single time. And so we did. And we did it through a little song and some physical movement. And so all the things I was just talking about, multisensory information, I could sit here and go X, X, X root two. And I know my ratios because we made like this little cheer to remember our 30, 60, 90 and 45, 90 ratios. But what's coming up in this conversation right now is something we talked about last time, which we haven't touched on this time. And that's the equity issue. Because the people here in this room, like we have enough schema, we have enough background knowledge in math, and you probably live lives that have been free of most major stressors, and you weren't exposed to massive adverse childhood experiences. And I could be wrong here; I might be making horrible assumptions. But if that's true for you, then you have greater cognitive capacity to be able to recreate those ratios every time. And if we say you don't need to memorize it because some students can recreate that, but the reality is that some can't. Like that's just that, I mean, maybe they could, but it's just really asking a lot to be able to reconstruct that every single time. It reminds me of those horrid worksheets for basic facts where it's like you do all these fun little problems, but then you have to like use the information to like decode it to be a letter. Then the letter means a different color and you color it into like, you know what I'm talking about? These like decoding workshops. Anybody?
Oh, yeah. You mean the ones where I would answer the first two right and then figure out the word, not do the rest?
Sure. So just think about those. I mean, I also grew up in the generation of those. And just think about how much mental load is used up doing useless stuff, translating it to words and then to colors and coloring things in. Like that's just, it's just not the best use. In my opinion, we need to decide when is it the best use to use our mental power to reconstruct something? And when is it just going to be helpful to know what it means and to have that conceptual understanding, but then just be able to retrieve it when it's time? And I think the key there is that there needs to be some cyclical review of the concept as you're going throughout. It's not like, hey, today we're going to introduce this. We'll do some, you know, patty paper folding and we'll explore this. And now I'm going to teach you the trick. And from now on, it's the trick. Like it's this little chant and we're done. Because then they're just going to lose, you know, the meaning that came with it and what it was really all about. So there needs to be this balance here. But in what context do we do that? I don't know, where's like the list of memorize this, don't memorize that. I don't know.
Sounds like a vote for spiraling to help with retention there.
Yes.
In that conversation. Yes. Just adding on to what you all were just talking about, just thinking, taking it to high school and talking to colleagues, they're wondering, should we have students memorize the quadratic formula, the unit circle, just like thinking about like big key points along the way in the high school curriculum. What do you guys think about those two specifically or anything else that comes to mind?
The quadratic formula is definitely helpful. Depending on what your purpose is. I mean, I'm just going to say depending on what your purpose is, because honestly, if you're using the quadratic formula, and I know Liesl's talking about the cognitive load and the time that it takes to go look something up, but if you don't remember the quadratic formula, in most situations, you can go look it up. I really personally am just more concerned with, can they use it? And I don't want the fact that they don't have it memorized or for whatever reason can't memorize it to be a reason that they can't do the problem. And I think that's where I come from with all of that. Just like what we were talking about with our special right triangles. I don't want them not having it memorized or not remembering which side is one and which side is two to be a reason for them not to do the problem. If they have it memorized, great, use it. And I tell them, I never tell them they can't memorize. I just don't emphasize memorize. I have students who take it upon themselves to memorize it. Or like I said, they see the pattern and they just see it then every time. So does it make things go faster? Absolutely. But I don't want it to be a barrier to something else because they don't have it memorized.
So Mandy, for the quadratic formula specifically, would you say that students should be able to derive that?
I write it on the board. If I'm testing with quadratic formula, I write it on the board because I want to know that they can use it. I want them, like, you're doing something with it. And I don't want that to be the reason that they can't continue on with it. And so now I always tell them, repetition, write it on your paper. Because if you write it enough, you're going to eventually store it.
Sure, sure. For me, with the quadratic formula, I mean, we could have a conversation about high school math and...
High school math podcast.
Say that again, Raj.
There's going to be a high school math podcast. Should we even have high school math questions?
Right, right. I'm on the no side. And I taught high school math for many years.
I'm with you.
Like,
I'm also with you. And I still teach high school math.
We're all the same team.
And let's just go like...
Future debate episode.
Yeah. So, I mean, that aside, whether we should even be, you know, whether this is even meaningful or relevant to learn, let's just assume that we're in the world where this needs to be learned. So for me, I go back to, I want to bring in the spirit of Jeff into this conversation and him talking about pedagogy, because I would put a lot of money that every single one of my students, even those that I taught 23 years ago, still have the quadratic formula memorized. Like, they know it and they would know how to use it because of how I taught it. We wrapped it. We taught it in a wrap. And so my students, they all know the quadratic formula. I know some of them are listening to this podcast. So shout out, please confirm that this is right. And so, you know, it goes back to how are we, the pedagogy, and how are we supporting memorization if it needs to happen or something like that. But I would say yes to the quadratic formula and yes to the unit circle would be my short answer in the world where high school math stays the way that it is. Caveat, asterisk.
Raj, any last thoughts on that?
Another asterisk.
I don't know. I definitely think you should know where they come from. You should probably at least have some understanding of how you can complete a square and lead yourself onto the quadratic formula. But I don't know that I could sit down and derive it right now myself. So, but I could Google it pretty quickly. I don't know. It's a lot to keep in there for your whole life, in my opinion, given that you probably won't use it after 12th grade or something. But that, like we said, that's another episode.
Yeah.
Unit circle. Yeah. Memorize it, I guess. Boy, that was pretty lukewarm, wasn't it?
I'd say just like put it on a 3x5 card. I might say that for unit circle. Yeah,
just have it handy.
Yeah.
So Liesl, I do.
And again, if you use it enough, if you're doing enough trigonometry and whatnot, you're going to end up knowing square root of 2/2 and certain other things, right? So it'll end up there. And it probably is valuable to memorize it in the short term for school, but I don't know. I don't think your brain needs to have that in there long term.
So Liesl, you were because I also, when I teach the quadratic formula, we sing it. It's not the rap, but we sing it, and we sing it a lot. I mean, I'm not saying I don't focus on it. I mean, I do want to put those skills in students' hands, but then when I get to the next year, they may not have been my students, or for whatever reason, they don't have this stored. That's where I don't want it to be a hindrance to them. Like, I'm not saying that it isn't beneficial to have things memorized. I just don't want memorization, the lack of memorization, to be a reason that they can't continue on with another concept. And I think sometimes we get to that point, oh, well, you don't know the quadratic formula, so you can't do any of these problems now. And we're robbing them of that ability to think through a problem because they can't memorize. In the same way with multiplication facts. Yes, it's easier. And we talked about this in the first podcast episode. It's easier to do a lot of things. But I try to come up with strategies for students who don't have them memorized because I still want them to engage with the math. I still want them to be able to continue on, even if the memorization isn't there.
All right, now we're really getting to some real issues in math, right? So what do we do when we have a student who comes to our class who doesn't have the prior knowledge that they need to be successful in the current class that we teach? So in the elementary school, it's like, oh my goodness, these kids, I mean, I have eighth grade teachers who come to me like, my students don't know their math facts. They don't know their multiplication facts. They can't, you know, what do I do? And this goes back to the whole conversation of like, math is moving too quickly. In my opinion, the curriculum is moving too quickly. And what's happening, unfortunately, is because teachers feel that pressure to cover all of their standards because of the standardized test and pressures from all these different sources, is that they just slide them a multiplication table or slide them their calculator and say, you know, well, let's just try to help you keep up. And that comes back to issues of class sizes are too big and there just isn't enough time to help and support and resources to help support that student. In an ideal world, I would want that student to still have the time and the resources to develop conceptual understanding of a multiplication fact. I wouldn't want to, but you know, I'm talking ideals, right? And same thing when they get to the quadratic formula, I would want to find a way, even if it's like everyone else gets to review this song or the rapper, whatever it is, because from an equity perspective, I really believe that teaching math equitably means we center our math instruction on those who are in the margins. And if those who had a poor instruction before, or who are experiencing chronic stress, or whose English isn't their first language, like we need to center our instruction on them. And my kid, like I will say, like my own kid who is multiple years ahead of grade level, He's fine. Let him, you know, do what, you know, but there are those who are struggling, and that's where we need to be able to center our focus on.
Okay. Changing gears a little bit here. Thank you for that wonderful thought. We had some questions coming in about assessments. We don't live in this ideal world, Liesl, like you were talking about. There's lots of testing, state testing, SAT testing, and testing within the school. So this question came from Courtney in Indiana. If we don't teach them through memory, will they be able to recall effectively enough for the test?
Not a time to test. And I make that distinction in my class because from the part of the United States that we're in, we take the ACT. Some students take the SAT, but ACT is more prevalent for us. And the math portion is 60 questions in 60 minutes. And I tell them, I said, when I introduce something, if somebody sees a pattern, I say, yes, that pattern right there will help you on the ACT. And I make that distinction. These are things that will help you answer these questions more quickly. Does it mean that if you don't memorize it, you can't engage with math, which is a big thing for me. I just want everybody in my classroom to feel like they can do math, even if they don't have tricks or don't have things memorized. That is just huge in my classroom. But I do tell them this will help you. It will help you answer those questions faster because that's a test where we just said, why do we time kids? Why is there speed attached? And then we give them a standardized test where it's timed, where they are set up to not be able to answer 60 questions in 60 minutes.
The reason that test is timed is so they can generate a bell curve.
The assessment movement is moving in the right direction. And that is away from a lot of these standardized tests, a lot of grading, and all of these extrinsic values we put on grades and times and things like that. Courtney, this is a really great question. And it depends on when the test is administered. So what Mandy's talking about is like an ACT that happens, you know, much later than when something's learned. I was just engaging in a conversation on Twitter about this just this week, where people were talking about the weekly spelling test. Oh, Raj, you were part of that conversation,
I was there.
Right?
Yeah.
And Rob too. That's right. Rob, you're the one who brought it up. You started the conversation. And so often in math class, we'll spend like a week or 2 weeks on this chapter, this unit, and then we'll test at the end. And for the most part, all we're doing is we're assessing short-term memory. We're just assessing short-term memory. And so much of what gets placed in short-term memory gets completely lost and forgotten and tossed out by your hippocampus, and it never makes it to long-term memory. And that's evidenced by the five of us right here, we could probably be really vulnerable and share what math classes we could really teach well right now. Like, do not put me in front of a calculus class right now. Do not. It's been too long. But you better believe that I had a very high A in calculus. You better believe I passed that AP calculus test because I knew how to cram information in the night before, a few days before the test, and just regurgitate it from my short-term memory. And so this is why this time of year right now, you see so many schools pausing instruction to reteach everything before the standardized test, because all they're doing is trying to shove it back into short-term memory because it got lost, because it wasn't taught in a meaningful way to begin with. And so we just spend, someone was calculating today, is like 10%. Oh, Jeff was calculating, it was like 10%, I think, of our school year, we spend just reteaching right before our state tests. And that is just a horrible testament to some of our pedagogical practices.
It is, and to the fairness of the teachers, because as a teacher listening to what you just said, like my hackles would have risen just a little bit. Because I've been in that situation. It's not their fault. They have too much information. Like you can't cover the material without just plowing through it. And that meaningful learning doesn't happen when you plow through it like that. It just, there's just not enough time for the amount of content that they're wanting us to somehow just drop inside. Like, I don't know.
Right. I mean, I think there's two sides to that coin there. And thank you for bringing it up, Mandy. Like, one, there is too much content. There definitely is. And I will be bold and say that there is a lot of room for improvement for the way in which we teach, that if we truly understood how the brain naturally learns, how to prompt with curiosity and make math relevant, that we could help students learn things better and faster than the way I at least was taught growing up in school. So I think there's both. Like, we can't, I don't want to put all of the blame on the system and on the testing culture, because they get plenty of it, they for sure. And I think it's important for us to reflect and know that there's always room for us to grow as well.
So I just want to interject a thought here, which is for those of you that know me, I think a lot about video games and how video games teach us stuff. And in a video game, there's never, well, there's boss battles, but you know, there aren't these ACT type time tests. How does a video game teach you anything? It's completely by feedback. It's active, descriptive feedback at all times. And in fact, you're being assessed all the time. You level up to the next level. That's a new assessment, but it's part of the game. It's part of the activity. And to me, you know, we need to rethink, why are we giving the end of unit test? Is it just to assign a grade so we can label people, or are we actually trying to measure? Or more importantly, Are we trying to give the learner feedback that makes them better at mathematics? And most end of unit tests, the goal of that test is not to give the learner feedback. It's just to give you just to rank you, right? At that particular moment in time for that particular set of content, then we'll move on to something else. So the real goal of assessment, I think, for teachers should be finding ways in which to give feedback. And that doesn't mean you have to give a test. It means you can walk around the room and just give feedback to kids who are actively working on problems all the time. And that feedback has to be such that it helps inform me as the learner how to do better the next time, because that's what a video game does. Every time you fall in a hole, you're like, oh, should have jumped earlier, should have jumped higher. When I play again, I'll adjust. And in math, it's you fall in the hole, you get an F a week later, and you're like, okay, cool, we're moving on to the next topic. I'm an F student.
And we leave you in that hole.
We do. Exactly. Thank you for finishing my analogy.
We leave you buried in that hole.
You don't get to restart with like all
of
your lives.
Play the game. That's right. Replays are free, people.
That's right. That's what I was going to say when you're talking about boss battles kind of as assessments. You get to do those over and over and over again until you pass the level. Like you just have to do it again. And you learn from it every single time that you do it. And yeah, when you said that, I was like, yes.
It's that formative, consistent formative feedback that informs the learner. What do they know? Where are their gaps? What do they need to be able to
should I be doing next time?
Moving forward. Yeah.
I've had several teachers talk to me about they've switched to like standards-based grading, and we could have a whole grading conversation, but they switched to standards-based grading, and administration has kind of said, we need to assess fluency on this standards-based grade card. Maybe not big picture on the report card itself, but how do you assess fluency? How do we know that things have been committed to the long-term memory, and how do we know, like, what's a good way? Because I know tried and true that we always see it, the time test, we've already talked about it. But if not that, then what? How do we do that?
You talk to them and you let them talk to you. I can't tell you how many times I've given students a written test. A simple example, I gave this like kindergarten kid, difficult addition problem was like 26 plus 38 or something. And he goes off, comes back, does the problem. I look at him like, oh my goodness, he's got the right answer. How does he do this? And I was like, hey, how did you? I'm like, man, this kid can like carry and regroup and place values, genius. He goes, well, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36. Okay, I have a very clear understanding of what this kid understands and doesn't understand. I wouldn't get that from a test. I just get the answer. You got to talk to him.
And then my teacher voice, I mean, yes, Raj, my teacher voice is like, but I have too many kids in my class. When do I find the time? How do I make that happen?
I'm in the ivory tower. I hear you.
One-on-one with all my students. But you're right. I mean, there's so many ways. There's one, there's, you know, like talking to students, listening to students. But, you know, students can self-assess as well. They can self-assess. And the group work, you know, Mandy's doing a lot of thinking classroom activities in her class. And so just, it's so visible because of the vertical non-permanent surfaces. You can just like see what they know. And I don't think there's one right or best way to formatively assess student learning.
But there are wrong ways.
I was waiting. I was like, but there are better than other ways. Yes.
Yes. But I mean, anything that places value on time or speed is that's not the purpose. That's not the purpose of math education. We don't know. We're not clear on what it is, but we know what it's not. So process of elimination, it is not about being fast.
Okay. Anything we ask a kid to do quickly, computer could do faster anyway.
All right. I want to try to start wrapping this up here. We have gone for quite a while, but thank you for all your good thoughts. I think I'll end with this question for me. And if Rob, you have one more you want to jump in or not. This is kind of based on a question that came from Sarah in Minnesota. She was asking how or if at all did you change your thoughts about this topic after the episode or after the online conversations that happened on Twitter or talking in person to people, what different things have been on your mind since that aired?
So I did actually, after I had some reflection time after that last episode. And I think the experiences that I had and the experiences that I have with my current students, memorization was very much rote memorization. And the lack of that rote memorization was preventing my students from being successful. And it made me realize that I really did have a very negative thought about memorization just because of the impact of it, when I probably should have less of a negative thought about it.
I think my reflection would be similar from last time is, you know, Mandy and I took a pretty controversial position, I guess, to say like, you shouldn't memorize, because we felt very deeply and strongly that the current way things are organized, and even Liesl mentioned this earlier in the conversation, it's primed to make it such that the incentive for a teacher is to focus a lot on just getting through it by having kids memorize in a mostly blind fashion, I guess, however that gets committed to long-term memory. And we're all against that. But in taking that position, I think I probably, having drunk that Kool-Aid for so long, you know, you do have to memorize things, obviously. And I think I'll probably end up providing more opportunities for that memorization to happen, but still after we've had a time to be curious about something, explore it conceptually, play with it, manipulatives, whatever it is, visual models, et cetera. Then at the end, if there needs to be some memorization, yeah, okay, fine, no problem. And some people do need that extra repetition, right? Like we all memorize things in different ways and whatnot. So I will probably include that a little bit more, but always at the end.
For me, it definitely had a lot of reflection, and really appreciate all of you who joined in that conversation and really challenged all of our thinking and helped us to stretch and to grow. Thank you for all of that. For me, a lot of my reflections were around, like we talked about at the beginning of the episode, the difference between memory and memorization, and just the narratives and the beliefs that we attach to some of these words and how they impact our pedagogy. That because memorization, so many of us in education right now grew up in the era of rote memorization, of timed rote memorization, and we know that that was horrendous and extremely inequitable and led to very little deep understanding of math. And so, you know, as is the story often in education, we swing the pendulum so far in the other direction. And it's like, don't memorize anything and just, you know, conceptual understanding for everything. And so for me, I'm trying to find that medium and realize that so many of these camps that we try to like passionately plant our flag in are not mutually exclusive, that we can, that both can be held true at the same time. And so I'm just been reflecting a lot about how our own past math experiences, plus the meaning we attach to words, create our own narrative. And then how the narratives that we hold about these pedagogies impact the way we teach, and thus impact how well our students learn. Because if I just cling to my belief of no memorizing, no memorizing, no memorizing, there are consequences for my students based on my own beliefs, even about this one pedagogical tool. So I just really loved the opportunity to reflect on the narratives I have created for myself and reinforced my own biases around things. And we'll continue to do that as I learn and grow myself.
Yes. Thank you all for that. I will say, like, I definitely have thought a lot about how I planted my flag in one camp, like you said, Liesl, and how important it is to not, I think, like Raj, Mandy, you're talking about how we overemphasize memorization, but also I don't want to underemphasize it for students, for equity and access and for their well-being. So there's lots of agreement on both sides and lots of good things there, and not going too extreme. I think we'll stop the questioning there and we'll start to wrap up here. Thank you to all of our listeners. If you want to talk more about this, throw out some more ideas, questions, some thank you to our guests, go to our Twitter at DebateMathPod to continue this conversation.
And like Chris said, thanks to our three guests, and shout out to Jeff, who couldn't make it tonight to hang out with us and continue with this conversation. You know, this was extremely thoughtful and respectful as a debate follow-up, our first one as a bonus episode. And we really, truly appreciate all of you and all of the listeners as well.
Yes, thanks to those of you listening. We hope you enjoyed and learned some more from this, explored some more of the nuance with memorization.
And as we wrap up, Mandy, where can listeners find you?
I am on Twitter at MandyTolanEDU. And I also blog at MakeMathNotSuck.com.
And Raj?
I'm on Twitter, Dr. Raj, at Dr. Raj Shaw, and online, DrRajShaw.com.
And Liesl, where can listeners find you?
You can find me on all social medias at Liesl McConchy, and on my website there as well, or you can find me somewhere in the world working with a school to help transform their pedagogy to be more aligned with how the brain naturally learns.
Wonderful. Thank you all. That's it from us. Have a great day.